Now, taking further, here is the famous Dr. Albert Einstein's quote, everything should be as simple as possible, but not simpler. Do not oversimplify. It's a quote by Albert Einstein, right? Now we talk about the first case, Martha Graham. The year is 1916, Los Angeles, US. Martha Graham graduates from Cumnock University in California, US to join the Denishawn School Dance Company in the atmosphere of great artistic ferment. Dance companies, when we say dance, we're talking about classical dancing, the Western classical dancing, in which there is a certain procedures of doing it. Everything is set in a certain fashion, in a very traditional way. There are certain costumes you are supposed to wear, and the dance has to be following certain steps. It's like anything classical, any classical music, classical form of art has to follow certain set norms by the classical creators. And thou shalt not deviate from there. It has to be that way. Puritan approach. So she was learning dance, and when she was learning dance, during that point of time when she was learning dance, there was a lot of artistic ferment. What was really happening was they were not getting much of work, they were not getting business. The people who saw those dances were the people who were not really understanding what was going on, because it was a Puritan form. And what used to happen is, as a result, not much of motivation was there, and there was a lot of the dance itself was becoming slowly waning away. It was not so popular, although it had got a lot of richness in it. This happens with many classical things. If you talk about certain old ancient languages, you know, when the ancient language is spoken in a Puritan form, people don't understand. After some time, the ancient languages vanish. Many languages have vanished from the face of the earth only because it's been in a very Puritan form. Not that Puritan form is wrong, but what really happens is it has to integrate with the understanding of people. Puritan is important. At the same time, it needs to integrate. So what did Martha Graham do? Dance, like painting and literature, was casting off the rigid conventions of the 19th century, and a handful of artists were pioneering the style that would come to be known as modernism. It's like blending a number of things together to form a dance which is classical in content. At the same time, people understand, common man understands it. Like, for example, in India, we have this Ramlila. It's a form of an integrative thinking. What are we doing? In the Ramlila, typically, stories of Ramayana is enacted by using the basic costumes which is available. And the language is not classical Sanskrit or whatever was written those days. It's a language which the masses understand. Typically, you can visualize a village, you know, at night, a small makeshift stage is made. These people put some nice war paints and all, and then they wear some costumes which resemble the mythical characters, and they come and talk in a language in which the people understand. If you look at the Ramlila, that enactment, from a Puritan point of view, it looks very profane, it's very incorrect, it's wrong. So the Puritans will condemn it, saying that, no, this is not the way you're supposed to talk. But by talking the language which the common man understands, the viewers understand, the villagers understand, what happens? They're able to connect the richness of the parable, the richness of the mythology of the Ramayana into the minds of people. So in other words, you have to connect to whatever you want to, the audience you need to connect. And when you connect, you've got to talk in a language, put it in the form in which they understand and accept. Only then the assimilation takes place. Right? So, this particular thing about mixing and matching different forms into the dance, classical dance, came to be known as modernism. For example, the costumes used to be typically the ancient type of costumes as dictated, as told that by the diehards. This is the way it should be. So, they have to go along and construct such costumes from, you know, specialized tailors and make them thing happen. And those costumes, when you wear and come on the stage for a dance, the common person who's sitting, the 21st century person, he doesn't relate with that. But when you change the costume slightly and make it related to the viewer, then suddenly there's a connection and the absorption also. Okay? Graham threw herself into the modern dance movement. She went wholeheartedly into it. And then what did she do? She observed the dance world was stuck in the past. Dances were choreographed to musical scores that were not written for a specific dance, and some were not written for a dance at all. some accompanying music was there, classical music, and she found there was no relevance between the music in the background, the choreography that's done, and the theme that was being enacted. Dancers wrote traditional ballet tunics, dancers wore traditional ballet tunics or folk costumes that bore no connection to the contents of the dance. Okay? Stages were sterile, they were very bland, there was nothing colorful, no backdrop, nothing. Okay? Two-dimensional flats, mere backdrops with little or no apparent relation to dancers or the dance. Martha Graham changed everything. Working closely with music composer Louis Host, Graham made music integral to dance it accompanied. First, we talk of dance, and there was some music going on. The music did not have any connection with the dance. Now she associates herself with a gentleman called Louis Horst, a musician, and she combines music and dance. Music which is relevant to the dance movements. So now there's an integration taking place. Next, what happens? For each important piece, she collaborated with renowned musicians like Aaron Copland to create a powerful synergy between music and choreography. Blending. She made music central to all her dance pieces, and Graham took keen interest in costume design, replacing ballet tunics. Tunics are basically dresses which has been worn by the ballet dancers. Ballet is a form of a classical form of a dance which is very graceful to look at. Okay, and she replaced ballet tunics and folk dresses with straight long shirts and simple leotards. Costumes with which the audience could identify. Whatever costumes, whatever dresses the audience were wearing, something similar to that, so that they could relate with the characters who were into the dance and the music. Right? The stage sets for her dances broke the mold as well. By incorporating sculpture and other three-dimensional elements, she added one more dimension. First it was dance, then she added music, now she added sculpture. What did she do? Now here is a lady, Martha Graham Revolution, that's what we call, and this is a type of a posture in which she is, and talks about simplification, right? Her long and productive collaboration with Isamu Noguchi, another gentleman, the renowned Japanese-American sculptor, resulted in revolutionary stage designs for globally famous dances. So she made some sculptures, put them in the backdrop of the stage, the dance was going on, the music was accompanying, was also blending with the dance, and the sculptures kept at the back, they were also in harmony with the whole dance. So it was a whole experience, not something that was being done there because of a classical richness and people couldn't connect. It's like the classical art films, very brilliantly made, but you need a certain amount of keenness to understand that. Not everybody in the common man has that keenness. So what happens to these art films? They're not very popular. They don't commercialize and make money. They're meant for exclusive audience. Same thing in this case of the classical dancing. So she took dance, she blended with music, and now she blended with the sculptures, right? In a sharp break from conventional dance practice, she explicitly considered the whole while working on every element of the production, rather than doing out each element to independent specialists. All the three had to come together. The dance person, the music person, and the sculpture. All of three had to understand each other's role in the larger picture. That is integration. Right? In doing so, she revolutionized the art form. She made it into something different. Theoretically, businesses and their leaders should take a similar, coherent, holistic approach to crafting their products and services, but they don't. Actually, this is what we are supposed to do. I have the production people, the product design people, the marketing people. Is it not important that all the three of us come together to understand that each other's work is related to the other? And when we sit together, when the CEO or the HOD or the general manager sits together, puts all of them together and makes each of them see the whole picture, would it not be a fantastic company? It would be. Right? Why is it we don't do it? We don't do it because of the factory setting. Factory setting means what? I've done it in the past. It's worked out very well. How did I do it in the past? By either or approach. This works very well. I don't want to get into too much of tension. Let me keep doing this. It's working well, and so it is the best. And I also justify that this is best and that is not good. The one I've eliminated. Factory setting. I'm not willing to change myself. And since I'm successful in terms of producing results, in terms of the position I'm holding right now, after spending so many years of experience, my factory setting becomes rigid. You know, when I conduct creativity workshops for leaders, it's very tough because many of them cannot come out of the box. And they swear by whatever are the success factors with which they are living. So to pull them out of the box, it's quite an effort, quite a challenge, because the factory setting is very strong in them, justifiably strong for their own sake. But when it comes to creativity, coming out and integrating themselves, they find it quite challenging, right? So the main reason for is the factory setting of the contemporary organizations, which is biased towards simplification and specialization. In every domain, human beings gravitate towards simplification and specialization. You take anything in life, first it grows simple. You know, a one-man show starts a business. Everything is under his control. Okay? Now what happens? He gives the best of service. Now since he gives the best of service, more customers come to him. Slowly what is happening? The company, which was a one-man show, simple, is turning complex. So when more customers come to him, he hires people. When he hires people, he compartmentalizes their work. Now each one is having his own compartmentalized work. He does the work and produces results to the best possible way, because that's how he's appraised. Now while he's doing this, he misses out on his correlation with the other departments, typically. And as the company keeps growing, they get more business, money comes in, sales and profits are coming in, but this integration is lost and the company runs. Now when it runs, when there are some issues that are coming up or the competition takes over, then he does not know how to handle it, because there's a factory setting which he has created by default, both to himself and to others. So that's exactly what happens by specialization and simplification. We cut prices by 5%, to give an example, and sales go up by 7%, good enough. We announce further cut, but sales do not increase. Does it not happen? We take some linear decisions. Cut cost, increase the margin, as a consequence, our profits will increase. Keep on cutting the cost, quality suffers. Keep the price wherever you are, keep on increasing the price by 5%, 6%, and hoping that you'll get more business, at some point it stops. Why? Because this decision is an outcome of an either or approach, wherein you're so sure price cut and cost cut and price raise will take care of my business. That's why many companies tend to fail in this, right? So one has to look at something much more different, right? So we find that customers, to our utter dismay, have switched to other competitors who brought out a new product with more attractions, because we are going by the linear approach in these two cases. Organizations seek to transform confusing interactive environments into less confusing, less interactive ones by decomposing domains and treating resulting subdomains as autonomous. In short, organizations simplify and specialize, so that what appears to be large and overwhelming, which appears to be chaotic, I simplify it so that it becomes manageable. But in the bargain, what happens is I tend to miss out on the larger picture, right? The linkages between the subdomains are not looked at, is what happens in that case. And then the famous 80-20 Pareto principle implicitly acknowledges that simplification is not the perfect solution to the problems of ambiguity and causal inconsistency. It is just a coping mechanism. Let's understand this. Pareto principle has got different ways of putting, different interpretations. It simply says that, to give an example, 80% of the problems in society, 80% of the problems in society are because of 20% of people, of the population. And it's a fact. If you see the social condition, the civic sense, which is happening in this one, you'll find that 80% of the problems are created by 20% people. So 80-20 principle tells you that the majority usually affects the small group. The majority appears significant, but the smaller one is more significant. Now this principle can be interpreted and discussed at length on from many different forms. But suffice it to say, for the purpose of discussion here, the 80-20 principle implicitly acknowledges that simplification is not the perfect solution to the problem of ambiguity and causal inconsistency. Just by simplifying, things don't happen, right? As comforting as simplification might be, however, impairs every step of the integrative thinking process. I've already explained this to you. Every time I simplify, I feel it's nice, I'm in control, I'm in charge. And when I do that, I'm in charge of what? One simplified bit, not the entire thing. And then the integrative thinking automatically stops. I don't put myself into further saliences and causality. Right? It encourages us to edit our salient features rather than consider the question of salience broadly. The 80-20 may lead you to more business, but creative resolutions spring from complexity. 80% of the turnover is because of the 20% of the efforts we put. So people focus the 20% efforts. Now, only focusing on that efforts does not create further leap in the business. I need to think something differently. That's where I need to spring, I need to go into the complexity of the situation rather than thumb ruling it to 80-20. Okay? Simplification makes us favor linear, unidirectional causal relationships even if reality is more complex and multidirectional. The simplifying mind would not have grasped Piers Handling's causal connection between the film festival prizes and the audience feeling of inclusion because it is not a straightforward linear relationship. Piers Handling, the topic which we took in one of the earlier modules, the Toronto International Film Festival, where he made it a point to see to it that the film festival was viewed by experts who knew the technicalities of the filmmaking, the production, etc., who finally gave the awards, but at the same time the participation of the audience who gave the commercial business to the films. So this integration is something which would not be understood by a simplifying mind. You know, we can take examples about our own society. With looking at the politicians of the land, for example, without giving them bad name, a politician is handling so many affairs of the state, so many things they have to do. It's not possible for them to do those things unless and until they have an integrative mind. These secretaries of the various departments in Delhi, how they handle so many complex situations together, it's possible only when they have integrative thinking. So when you're handling a lot of complexities and you're able to move ahead, whatever actions they take may not be understood by you and me. I'm not taking sides of politicians and secretaries. I'm not taking sides of top people. Many times top people are into integrative thinking and they take some action. We look at the action very linearly. And when we look at it linearly, we do not understand why they are doing and we start chucking them off. But when those results come out fruitful and they sustain for a long period of time, then we realize, hey, that's a leader. The process of integrative thinking, we are not understood because we have simplified and specialized. So next time you come across something that is not making meaning to you, don't chuck it away. Ask yourself, why is it not making meaning to me? And chances are that it is not making meaning to you because you are into the trap of simplification and specialization. An accountant, accomplished chartered accountant, very good in his practice, good business he has. Now he would not understand, he might not understand the language of a marketing guy when he comes to sell a merchandise. He may not understand the integrative approach of a salesman who wants to sell him a merchandise for his own convenience. It's possible. Won't you all agree that, you know, every specialist looks at things from his point of view alone, and we reject people and we take stands and we form opinions and strong prejudices. Now by doing this, our life runs, nothing wrong about it. But when we integrate, we see the other side of the story also. So anything that doesn't make sense to me, if I can take my example, I pause and ask myself a question, where am I getting into a trap of not understanding this complexity? And then suddenly, I see, yes, there is a connection. I am not able to see it because I have taken the stance. But because I take the stance, it doesn't mean that is wrong or that is incorrect. So when I take a different stance, I see that, my God, this is something different. There is a wisdom in all those actions that are taken at the top level, which many of us don't understand. And we don't understand because we look at it from a very narrow point of view, considering the position in which we are. Okay? So, simplification also encourages us to construct a limited model of a problem before us, whatever it might be, and alternatives we consider are meager and unattractive, closing any remaining avenue to an integrative resolution. Now, what is specialization? It's a variant of simplification. If simplification attempts to understand the whole picture by making it more shallow and superficial than it really is, the specialist attempts to preserve depth and thoroughness by masking out all but a few square inches of the vast canvas. Medicine presents a classical case of specialization. First, there are official specialties such as obstetrics and gynecology, all to do with, you know, pregnancy, women's problems. Then there are subspecialists such as neonatology, one part of the ONG, that is obstetrics and gynecology. And then what happens, these subspecialists possess a staggering depth of knowledge of their corner of the medical universe, but only a thin layer of knowledge about the medicine outside their subspecialty. Subspecialists also tend to take little interest or no responsibility for development outside their subspecialties. I gave this example earlier. Now, this neonatologist is a person who's to deal with the delivery of the baby and all the associated things with that. So he has become so super specialized in the GNO area that he may tend to miss out on the larger picture. He may administer certain medicine to the mother or the child, which may be in isolation of other factors which may affect the child or the mother. That's what we are trying to say here, right? At its best, medicine does wonders for the sick, but at all too frequent worst, specialized medicine cares for discrete parts of the body without ever recognizing the whole person standing before it. Dissatisfaction with the dehumanizing consequences of conventional medicine specialization has spurred the emergence of alternative medicine movement. He's giving an example about modern medicine. And today we all know that we don't stick to one form of healing. We try to look for alternative healing. The alternative healing is not a type of a contamination of each other. It's just to know that the medical science, for example, if I can talk about it objectively, is based on certain sets of studies taken for long periods of time, and then they diagnose and say that this symptoms is equal to this disease based on certain statistical studies, etc. Now, it's possible that a person has got a very high blood pressure in reading, but he may not have symptoms of blood pressure. I'm just giving an example. I'm not disputing anything medical. Now, such a person is normal as far as everything else is concerned, except that the reading of the blood pressure is high. Now, can I give him blood pressure medicines? Conventional medical science will say yes, and they will give some reasons for that, which are also correct. Now, is the blood pressure reading important or is the well-being important? Is the question. I'm just opening up an objective view. I'm not taking sides. Now, there are certain areas of medicine, for example, since we're discussing this, which have got alternative ways of looking at it. Certain cures are taking place not by the conventional medicine. That's because somebody has gone along and integrated the thinking. I know doctors, allopathic doctors, who prescribe Ayurvedic medicines. I know Ayurvedic doctors who are prescribing other forms of medicine like homeopathy, and people are integrating it. When they integrate it, what happens? The purpose for which the whole body of specialization is created, namely for healing people, is actually taking place. If the healing is happening by not one path, by multiple paths, why not heal people? That's integrative thinking, right? Business world has proceeded down a similar path of specialization with equally unsatisfactory results. It has experts in finance, experts in marketing, experts in accounting. But as Drucker pointed out, to succeed, you do not need creative market decisions or finance decisions. You need creative business decisions. All these people, the finance and the marketing people and the accounting people, have to integrate to give a business solution. Functional specialization is especially inimical or hostile to integrative thinking because it undermines productive architecture, the keeping in mind of the whole while working on the individual parts. Functional specialization encourages the sequential or the parallel resolution of discrete parts of a business problem. It says each of the functional specialization are separate, and it starts making it operate in isolation rather than coordinating and integrating. The result is that what is optimal from the perspective of one function will take precedence over what is optimal for the firm as a whole. This happens in certain management decisions. Let's say the CEO of the company has been an ex-production man. 20 years he has spent in production, then by his career growth, he has come and become the CEO. There's a very good likelihood that his production thinking will always take a precedence whenever he's taking a decision for the company. To the extent to which he will support his production boys with whatever proposals they come, and he may tend to reject other very good proposals which are coming from other departments. So his thought process, his salience takes a precedent as far as the company's well-being is concerned. This is disastrous, because if he thinks only in production terms and very peripherally in other terms, then the production consciousness, it pervades the company, which may not be conducive for the health of the company in the long run. They may tend to neglect marketing. They may tend to neglect after-sales service. So this is one pitfall that happens when you're into specialized thing. So now we are discussing about two types of resolutions. Sequential followed by parallel resolution. Very simple, easy to understand. I'm not reading out from the slides, I'm just explaining it to you. And I'll keep on flipping the slides, okay? I'll give a pause so that you read the slides. Now, what's a sequential resolution? A sequential resolution goes something like this. There's a research and development department in a company which develops a certain product using all the R&D inputs, designing, etc. Then what it does is it gives that particular product drawings, etc. to the production people. And they say, produce it. What is the assumption? That the R&D has brought out the best product. They have brought the best product with respect to their limited R&D thinking. It goes to the production, and they must have overlooked the production limitations or the production facilities which are available. When the drawing comes to the production shop floor, these people are forced to produce that particular product even if they do not have the proper infrastructure. That's why we use a term called R&D throws over the wall. The designs come to them and they have to do it. This was happening earlier. When I was in industry as a production person, I used to come across many drawings coming from the design department which were impractical for us to manufacture on the shop floor. They were right designs, but they were not pragmatized. They were not made into something that can be easily manufactured given the facilities in the factory. Why? Because the R&D people did not have a complete idea about what is going on. They did not integrate their thinking with the production people. In my turn as a production person, could not integrate my thinking with the R&D's way of thinking. Now, this led to a lot of mismatch, as a result of which what used to happen? We used to work in isolation. And the interfacing used to create a lot of stress, and there was a lot of misunderstandings. To the extent to which people were taking stands. Production people used to say that we are the best, and R&D states that we are the best. And it used to get personal sometimes with a lot of clashes. Right? Now, this is what is sequential resolution.